Earlier this week in Washington, the House of Representatives convened a moment of silence for victims of the Orlando shooting.
The chair asks that the House now observe a moment of silence.
A few Democrats walked out in protest during the silence. Then, when Speaker Ryan tried to reconvene things, chaos erupted.
SR 5312, a bill to amend the High Performance Computing Act of 1991 to authorize activities.
They're shouting, "Where's the bill?" and "No leadership," because many Democrats were angry Speaker Ryan would not let lawmakers consider gun control bills. Today on the 21st, we talk about prayer and action with Chicago minister Reverend Dr. Otis Moss III. Also, we'll explore why some Illinois immigrants are being told it will take at least 3 years for their asylum cases to be heard in Chicago courts. And we convene a panel of Asian American dads as an early Father's Day celebration. That's all coming up on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Almost as soon as news spread of the horrific mass shootings in Orlando this weekend, the hashtag #PrayForOrlando appeared. Many people said their thoughts and prayers were with the victims, their families, and the city. And almost as soon as that, there was a backlash against politicians who said their thoughts and prayers were with the victims. Many pointed out many of those same lawmakers voted against or simply don't support laws that work to curb gun violence or ban assault weapons or even to prevent people on a terrorist watch list from purchasing weapons. Connecticut Congressman Jim Hines said he would not attend one more moment of silence because he said it was a mockery to victims. And he started a new hashtag, Policy Change for Orlando. Today on the 21st, we're talking about prayer in action. And we want to ask you your thoughts. What role do you think prayer has in response to national tragedy? And what about action? You can give us a call. Our phone number, as always, is 1-800-222-9455. Again, that's 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet your thoughts to 21st Show. I'm joined now by Reverend Dr. Otis Moss III. He's the senior pastor of Trinity United Church of Christ in Chicago. Pastor Moss, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you very much, Nyla. I'm delighted to be on.
And I wanted to make clear, this is a conversation about two different things, right? Because it's how people have reacted to politicians saying their thoughts and prayers are with victims. But it's also about people telling their friends and other ordinary citizens that prayer isn't enough. With that kind of context, I wanted to start with your thoughts on this and your thoughts on this tragedy. And I'm wondering what you first thought when you heard the news on Sunday morning.
I was absolutely horrified when I heard, and I was looking in terms of what kind of response can we have immediately for people trying to make sense of this incredibly painful, horrific act of hate. And so in our church, one of the things that we did, we lifted up our LGBT community, asking them to come to the altar and praying with them, recognizing that there are people who have family members, friends, who were affected by this tragedy. But prayer served as a segue to deal with post-traumatic stress, and then serves as a second segue to talk about policy change.
Let's talk about that first segue about prayer, as you say, as I guess you would, I don't know if you would define it as prayer as comfort. And I know you wrote a Facebook post, you offered a prayer for people, and this was a couple of days ago. Can you share a little bit about what your prayer was initially as a prayer of comfort for people?
Saying that we stand with, we are in alliance with those who are mourning, that the waters of healing, that the rain of comfort, that the showers of restoration would fall on those who are experiencing this crime. This is a national tragedy. It's traumatic to hear about it. It's traumatic to witness it. The stories that have been coming out have been very painful. My own family raising questions, my children raising questions, why can't we ban guns? So there is a national dialogue around the intersection of race, religion, and orientation. And we have to have a true conversation about how, one, our policies affect these issues, and two, how many people of love and compassion have been drowned out as a result of politicians, I would say, who have been appealing to the brokenness in humanity in order to stir up controversy instead of stirring up compassion and care for people.
Well, and I think it's such an interesting thing in this moment about how much we think about words. And it's almost, I think, especially in the immediate wake of something like this, there is a lot of attention paid to the words that people use. And I wanted to ask you about that moment, about the language that we saw. And as you said, you think, and I saw a post where you said, look, I'm not going to share anything that's attacking or denigrating or humiliating anyone. Why do you think it's so important what our initial words are? And do you think that we're at a moment where, unfortunately, there is a lot of division and people are using a lot of hateful language?
I think that there is a lot of hateful language that's out there. I think that we are in a space of regression where you have a group of people who feel as if they are losing, and why we have statements, let's make America great again. I raised the question last night I was speaking. I said, when we speak about America, make America great again, we have to look in historical context. Is that when we were, you know, taking land from Native Americans, when African people were enslaved, when women could not vote? You know, the list goes on and on and on. So we need to be careful of this romantic gaze that only focuses on one particular community. We want, I like to say, a gumbo. We want to bring together all these different elements that people say do not go together. But when the spirit of compassion and love is simmering in the pot, all of a sudden you've got an incredibly tasty meal. And that's what happens when we look on the beautiful side of orientation, of race, and of religion, instead of us looking on the horrific side.
I'm speaking with Senior Pastor of Trinity UCC in Chicago, Otis Moss. We're talking about prayer and action. We'd love to hear your thoughts on this. You can call us. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet as well to 21st Show. Earlier on Facebook, Colleen said, I think the offense, or I'd probably say it's more of a frustration, stems from the idea that offering a prayer without more feels like lip service for those who are actually in a position to change the laws. So while memorials and religious service and vigils certainly would offend or bother me with respect to the shooting, it feels insincere for Congress to pray or observe a moment of silence and then do nothing more when they are the ones who could actually work to change the situation. So I wonder, as we think about that, Reverend
Moss. I completely agree with the post. It's almost word for word something that I said recently when I was speaking. Absolutely. Absolutely. It's very disingenuous when politicians stand up and say, let's pray, but yet they are creating policies that create an atmosphere, or utilizing language that creates the atmosphere where we embrace this kind of hate.
But I think it's also an interesting thing with Americans, and I'm curious your observations about this, because I think as a country, culturally, we're very open about religious expressions, or saying expressions that are religious, like saying our thoughts and prayers are with you. And in a way, I almost feel like it's when we say, how are you? It's just a way that a greeting, and we're not necessarily even asking someone how they are. Do you think that's sometimes part of when we say things like our thoughts and prayers are with someone, in a way it actually doesn't have much meaning behind it?
I think for some, absolutely. I think that when you say your thoughts and prayers, it should be something intentional. You should actually, I believe, kind of the tradition that when you make that statement, you're making a covenant to say that you are going to lift that person up by name, that not only thoughts, but prayers, and that you are also going to be focusing on how you can assist a community or individual or a family that may be in need, thoughts and prayers. We believe out of our tradition, the African-American church tradition, that when praying people come together, that action is birthed out of it. Things that we cannot even imagine is birthed out of that. And that comes out of the civil rights movement, specifically Fannie Lou Hamer, who believed that in order for us to take action in Mississippi, it first begins in the prayer room.
Why do you think that's important?
Well, when people begin to pray individually or collectively, one, there is there's community building. Two, there is listening, learning to be silent before the presence of God, before the divine, and being contemplative and reflective of how we engage that which we lift up. Unfortunately, in America, we've turned prayer into like an ATM, you know, like God works for us and God's going to hook us up, instead of a reflective listening aspect. And that's what pretty much early ancient Christianity was about, not saying hook me up or bless me, but how can I move so that I can be a more compassionate person that is a blessing to other people?
I wanted to, as we're thinking about that and we're thinking about the way that everyone has reacted, I'm curious your thoughts on sort of the cycle of how this particular shooting has played out. And by that, I mean, we've obviously been here before. This has happened before. This hasn't happened on the scale, obviously, but we have been through multiple mass shootings, multiple situations of violence, and then there's sort of a way people tend to respond. And I actually wanted to play something that Stephen Colbert talked about this, because I think he did a good job of sort of summarizing the national mood the other night.
You have a pretty good idea of what most people are going to say. You know what a president, whoever it is, will probably say. You know what both sides of the political aisle will say. You know what gun manufacturers will say. It's as if there's a national script that we have learned. And I think by accepting the script, we tacitly accept that the script will end the same way every time, with nothing changing. Now, these people in Orlando were apparently targeted because of who they love. And there have been outpourings of love throughout the country and around the world. Love in response to hate. Love does not despair. Love makes us strong. Love gives us the courage to act. Love gives us hope that change is possible. Love allows us to change the script. So love your country. Love your family. Love the families and the victims and the people of Orlando. But let's remember that love is a verb. And to love means to do something.
Pastor Moss, as you think about that, what do you think? I mean, we've talked about sort of the first half of this. You started by saying that you think that prayer offers a space for contemplation, but then there's a secondary reaction that needs to happen. What would you suggest people do next? What have you called your congregation to do?
Well, the first thing I'd like to say is that, you know, Colbert is just completely right. The second thing is he is also a person of faith and has a reflective aspect of creatively looking at these things. But number one is the trauma is the immediate. The second piece is the policy pressure. And so as a congregation, like for the listeners to know, here we are. We're a congregation on the south side of Chicago. We experience gun violence consistently and are engaged not just in the mourning moment of burying young people, but engaged on the policy piece. One of the pieces, and I'd like to put this out there to the listening audience, coalition of faith leaders and organizers, we came together to put pressure on gun manufacturers and to put pressure not only on the city of Chicago, but the state of Illinois and also nationally, that they should no longer purchase guns, meaning, you know, the largest purchaser of guns, Chicago Police Department, from manufacturers that have a high percentage of guns that find their way into the hand of what are called crime dealers. One way to put pressure, but we have a huge pushback from the NRA, even though it makes complete sense. Could you imagine if the military said we will no longer purchase from X manufacturer because it ends up in the hands of those combatants against the U.S. military? Second thing is smart gun technology that we have pushed for, the idea that the gun that is in the hand of an individual cannot be shot unless it's owned by a particular individual. The third piece, now this is just, you know, this is me in particular, but I just really think that we need to close every particular loophole as possible. But there is a deep love, a gun culture that we have to deal with. And the NRA, which began as a hunting organization, has primarily become a lobbying organization for gun manufacturers, and they have no compassion or care for those who are victims of gun violence.
Pastor Moss, what's your response to people who were listening, who were thinking, I'm a Christian and I support I support, you know, the right to carry a weapon, and I support the Second Amendment. What would your response be to them?
My response would be that's fine for you to take that particular perspective. But I do not believe that our call as people of faith is necessarily for us to conceal and carry. I live in an area where we have conceal and carry all the time. It may not be legal, but it's not making anyone safer. It's one thing for hunting. It's another thing if you are, you're a part of, you want to shoot and you want to be able to target practice. But we are talking about 500 people in this community who are killed. We're talking about 50 people who were murdered in Orlando because of our gun culture and our access to guns. Yes, mental health is a part of this, but we're even giving lip service to mental health because there are those who say, let's focus on mental health, but yet are not putting even any money. We've had 26 mental health facilities close in Illinois, 26. And yet everybody talks about we need to deal with mental health. The biggest mental health facility in Illinois, well, in Cook County, is the jail.
Mm, yeah.
So I think it's disingenuous. To talk about mental health, to say that we want to conceal and carry, when you are talking to communities that are experiencing gun violence. And that is why our community mourns with those in Orlando, because we understand your pain and we stand with you in reference to this pain, and we stand with you to make policy change.
Otis Moss III is a senior pastor at Trinity UCC in Chicago. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much, Nyla.
The 21st is made possible by the Library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, showing and preserving significant collections and digitally archiving irreplaceable information so that it is forever accessible to students, faculty, and the community at large. The University Library at Illinois.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. This weekend, if you've forgotten, is Father's Day. A few days ago, we saw a story in the Chicago Tribune about the perception of Asian dads and masculinity in the U.S. And the article drew some attention to the cultural differences between Asian and American parenting styles. So we thought we would invite a panel of Asian American dads from Illinois to share their perspective as sons of Asian immigrant fathers and now as fathers themselves. Joining us in studio right now are Joe Yoon and Tony Thomas. Thanks for being here with me, guys.
Thanks so much.
And on the line with him from Chicago is Edward Lee Young. Edward, thanks for joining us as well.
No, thank you for having me on.
I thought we could start with if you guys could share maybe one story of your childhood. And I will start. I've obviously not an Asian dad, but I have an Asian dad. So I have a West Indian father by way of. And I remember, I think we all have, as we think about our childhoods, as we think about our parents, I'm first generation American. I remember being as a kid, you have these moments where you're kind of embarrassed by your parents and maybe them not being American, especially when you're a kid, because I think you just want to fit in. And I feel like I remember my name, first of all, having like a first and last name that nobody could ever pronounce, and then having curry in my lunch and being kind of embarrassed that like I didn't have ham and cheese sometimes. And I'd be like, this is so smelly. And even growing up in Miami, where every kid is an immigrant, the curry in my lunch was not a popular thing. And I wonder if you guys first, as you're thinking about your childhood and you think about your upbringing, if you guys have stories like that as well. Joe?
Yeah. One of my most vivid memories was when my dad was working at a pretty large corporation here. You know, they had that classic company picnic and the classic company picnic softball game. And my dad was really into baseball and softball. He was actually kind of like an amateur doing his own thing with different leagues. And so
was this something that happened when he came from Korea?
This is when he came from Korea into America. And so he had like the full uniform, for baseball, softball. And for this picnic, they said they're going to have a softball game. And I was there, and the softball game was just about to start. And I saw my dad disappear And then he reappeared. And to my horror, you know, obviously with softball games, everybody just kind of wears what you wear. He came out with his full-out baseball uniform. And, of course, everybody was just staring at him like, what are you doing? He had his, like, custom bat. I was mortified.
He was super excited about
the game. Yeah, he was super excited. I was mortified because I knew. I was very young, but I still knew, oh, that's not what, you know, softball is like here. It's just supposed to be, like, plain clothes. And unfortunately, I kind of actually then ended up getting a little bit angry at everybody because, you know, I could see that they were kind of making fun of him.
Yeah, it's hard, right? I wonder if you have – and, Edward, I don't know about you. This is part of before you even become a parent, when you were a child of immigrants, I think you're kind of always straddling these cultures. I mean, Edward, would you agree with that?
Yes, but I think in my circumstance, because I was born and raised in Vancouver, Canada, that situation was a little bit different because Vancouver has a much higher Chinese population. So I think like when I was growing up, even though, you know, we were in Vancouver, in a, you know, Canadian city, but then we tend to, my family tend to live around, you know, in neighborhoods where there was a very strong Chinese presence, you know, went to school, there were a lot of Chinese kids there. But definitely I can relate to, you know, some of the experiences that were described, like simple one was like, you know, my mom would pack, rice and other Chinese food for lunch, and then I would bring out this weird thermos that would, you know, keep my lunch warm, whereas everybody else is bringing out sandwiches and juices and all that.
Yeah, my mom so was really big into that thermos. Yeah. I had that too. I don't think that happens anymore.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, well, actually, you know, as we say, like, you know, things that we pick up from our parents that, well, guess what I'm doing to my kids right now?
Are you sending them with a thermos?
But, you know, the difference is that my kids actually enjoy it. You know, they actually, if I give them a choice between picking sandwiches versus, you know, bringing rice or noodles for lunch, they would actually prefer the rice or noodles. So, you know, I think, you know, it's maybe things are a little bit different.
I think things
now.
Have right. Yeah, Tony, I was going to ask you about that. Tony, I don't know. Did you grow up around a lot of, was there a large Indian community where you were growing up? Where did you grow up, Tony?
Yeah, I grew up in Chicagoland area. So I grew up with, yeah, a pretty large, like, Indian church community. So I had, like, kind of two worlds I lived in my Indian church and then, like, my predominantly Caucasian school friends kind of thing.
Yeah, Joe, you had that as well.
Yeah, I grew up in Buffalo Grove, which was predominantly at that time Jewish. And I actually, for a period of time, I didn't even know that a bar mitzvah and a bat mitzvah was a Jewish thing because it was just something that everybody did. But that was kind of the community that I lived in.
Well, and I wonder what kind of stands out for you, your relationship with your father when you were a kid? Joe, do you want to start?
Yeah, I think for my relationship, I mean, definitely it was a pretty typical Asian relationship where my father was working a lot and, you know, we didn't get a lot of FaceTime, didn't really talk a lot. So it wasn't necessarily cold, but it was just, you know, there wasn't a lot to say. My dad was usually very tired, just working a lot. And, you know, I was just focused on trying to do well in school. And you know, we kind of grew up not that obviously wealthy. So, you know, it was just kind of like we just had to get what we had to get done.
Mm-hmm. Edward, how about you?
Yeah, very, very similar. I mean, my dad was, you know, he was working long hours. And, you know, when he came home, he was more of the parent that did most of the disciplinary action. So, you know, there was a little bit of more fear of my father when I was growing up. But, you know, I'd say that, you know, once the grandkids came around, then, you know, our relationship has changed. So, you know, as I've become more mature, you know, I kind of understand and see where he's coming from and why he was acting the way he was. And, you know, with the grandkids now, he has mellowed out tremendously. So, you know, it's kind of interesting to see, you know, how he was like before and now. And when I talked to him, I said, how come you let the grandkids get away with stuff that you'll never let me get away?
Yeah, no, and, I think everybody has answered. What does he say?
Yeah. And then he just said, well, you know, that's, you know, my job as a grandparent now is just to spoil the kids.
Well, and also would he say it's his job as like, oh, well, your dad's in Canada, right? So would he say it's also his job as a Canadian grandparent? Like, do you wonder if he was still in Hong Kong, do you think he would have the same answer?
Oh, it'll be the same. I think it's just more of like, you know, the way that they just want the grandkids to be happy, right? So, you know, they're a lot more lenient of letting them do things or get things that they want than, you know, as, you know, when I was growing up. So, you know, so it's kind of interesting now that I reflect back to see, you know, what he was like before and what he is like now.
Mm-hmm. Tony, I wonder, do you find yourself saying any of the same things to your kid that your dad used to say to you, your kids now?
I don't know if the same exact language, but, you know, my dad was pretty strict growing up and, you know, pretty demanding, especially in terms of studies. My kids are pretty young. My oldest is still in just going to kindergarten.
So you haven't
soon,
had the grade. You haven't had the Asian parent report card conversation yet where they say, what's this A minus?
Yeah, exactly.
Did everybody have that conversation?
Absolutely.
I'm not the only one, right? Yeah. Okay.
So, but I could see it coming out a little bit, that expectations and, you know, desire for them to succeed and strive, you know, it's somewhere embedded inside of me, I think, still.
Joe, do you feel like you're Asian American? As an Asian American dad, do you feel like you have sort of melded both what your Asian dad taught you and then sort of what your experience now as someone who grew up here and is American? Do you feel like it's a combination of that?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I feel like I have a pretty good grasp of American culture at this point. I'm American. But at the same time, I can totally recognize, you know, why my parents did the things they did and the things about their culture that are so beneficial. And so I try to kind of do a mix between the two, my wife and I, because we both kind of grew up in the same situation. So, you know, for example, with
like
our
what?
Kids, with our kids, I think we will be pretty not pressuring or anything like that, but we'll have a high standard with regards to if we see a talent in them, then, you know, we will say, you know, go for it and give them every opportunity to go for it. But at the same time, you know, if they don't come home with straight A pluses, you know, I don't think I'm going to, you know, go crazy or anything like that.
Well, and I'm thinking about a story that you have told me about kind of career choices that you wanted to make as a kid. Can you share the story of how you ended up on your current career path and what your dad said?
Definitely a little different. So, you know, growing up, we as Koreans, we kind of had three career choices. You could either be a doctor, you could be a lawyer or an engineer. And it was really serious. Like, we all know this. It was those three. Businessman was added later as an option. But so when I was growing up, I was actually really into music. I did viola performance, and I was starting to get offers for scholarships in high school. My sophomore year, I started to get scholarships, and I started to seriously consider maybe I'll major in music. And my senior year, when I had the discussion with my father, it just basically came down to, you're not going to do that. You're going to be, you know, one of the three. And being that I was more kind of inclined to computers, I ended up majoring in computer science. I am now a computational data analytics guy. You know, that is kind of what I'm doing. But with that said, I appreciate it now because I can understand I can still enjoy music, but I'm in a career that actually is a pretty good career.
Well, and I should say, for those of you who recognize Joe also runs the Social Media Analytics Lab at the University of Illinois, who's one of our partners. So Joe is occasionally on the 21st in that capacity, although today he's not doing that. Edward, I wonder, are there lessons that you learn from your father you very intentionally want to pass on to your children?
Yeah, I guess, like, you know, ultimately, you know, in the beginning, you know, he was really stressing on, like, you know, getting good grades. And I think the part that was missing was, you know, he didn't really explain to me, even when I was in high school, you know, why was that important? You know, it's just more of like, you know, you need to get, you know, as many, like, you know, get as high of grades as possible, get into the best university as you can. And, you know, surprisingly, it was actually my mom that actually wanted me to go into medicine. And she was the one that was really pushing me to become a doctor. And my dad was more of telling me, well, you know, computer science was an up-and-coming thing, maybe you should go into that. So that was a little different and a little strange. But I think the lesson that I've learned from, you know, my dad when I was growing up and I'm passing on to my kids now is, like, you know, the work ethic part, you know. You know, even though he really pushed for me to get, like, you know, the A's and all that in school, it wasn't, you know, when I didn't achieve what he expected me to achieve, it wasn't the end of the world. So I think, like, you know, that's the thing that I want to pass on to my kids is, like, you know, you not necessarily getting straight A's, but, you know, you put in your honest effort, you try your best, and, you know, and then the difference will be, like, you know, maybe I won't get as upset if if my daughter or my son tries his or her best and they end up with, like, you know, a C or a B, you know, whatever, as long as the effort is there.
you can barely say the C, Edward. I feel like you really couldn't get that one out. But I will say you're getting big thumbs up in the studio for...
it's anti-cultural, so it's difficult.
Tony, what about you? I mean, what kind of... what kind of lessons do you feel like you are carrying on or you're going to carry on with your kids?
I think similar to what was said earlier, I think about work ethic. You know, I think growing up, I didn't appreciate it. Definitely my dad ran a business and, you know, growing up, I didn't really understand what all went into it. But I think being older now and seeing, you know, how hard he worked and then just also how generous he is too. Like, I think every time I go home, you know, I mean, I'm a pastor right now, so As an Indian son, I should be supporting him, but I just don't have the means to be able to do that. But every time I go to my dad's house, like every time I leave, he won't say many words, but he'll just like slip a check into my hand and be like, here, this is, and he'll make up some reason, like this is for, you know.
Have you guys, yeah. Well, when I think about, if I don't know how much affection your dads would have shown you growing up, but are you guys surprised or is it, do you see a difference with how they treat your kids, Joe? How much affection they show your...
Yeah, I mean, I tell my dad now he's a different person. I mean, even the other day he was FaceTiming with my two-year-old daughter. He's saying, I love you. He's kissing the screen. I mean, you know, again, not that he was cold growing up, but, you know, we just generally never hugged. You know, there was no kisses. There was no I love yous. There was just kind of an understood
right,
we're
you knew
family.
That. You
yeah,
knew
we,
that.
We knew we're family.
Sure.
And, you know, everything was good. But, you know, as a grandparent, it's just a different person. I don't know who that person is.
Yeah, and I also wonder, as you guys are just thinking about being Asian-American dads now and children, I'm thinking about what we were saying in the beginning, even how much American culture has changed and how much more we're seeing so much more Asian-American men in pop culture. You know, there's like Fresh Off the Boat. You're seeing Aziz Ansari, I think that Master of None episode of Asian Parents. I watched it with my parents, which had varying degrees of how amused they were when we sat down and watched that. But do you think that sort of changed also about, I think, maybe having more mainstream depictions of Asian Americans? Do you think that makes it easier for your kids than maybe it was for us? Tony, what do you think?
Yeah, I feel like there's a trend where being different than mainstream is almost cool now. And so I feel like growing up, being different was definitely kind of looked down upon. And I felt like as an Indian, I felt like I wanted to be white, actually. And I hated kind of sticking out. But I think there was a shift for me, at least personally, and I feel like in culture in general, where being Indian was, there was some sort of pride in that, and there was some sort of respect that you kind of had of being different. And, you know, Bollywood, you know, all these sorts of things, it's becoming more, I guess, acceptable in the mainstream culture. So I think our kids might, in some ways, be seen as cool, maybe. I don't know what they'll face, you know, growing up.
I want to thank our three dads for our Asian American dad panel, which we convened in honor of Father's Day. You guys should all say, I should say happy Father's Day to you and to your dads, right?
Happy Father's Day.
Happy Father's Day, Daddy.
And I should say that to my dad, too, who's always listening. So happy Father's Day, Dad, early. So I want to thank Joe Yoon, Tony Thomas, and Edward Leung for joining us. Thanks.
Thank you.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. There are more than 20,000 immigrants in the U.S. who have pending cases in Illinois, and the average wait time is now there more than 1,000 days for those court cases to be processed. That means life in limbo for these people, even those who are applying for asylum protection. Just about an hour ago, a Democratic representative, Luis Gutierrez from Chicago, joined the American Immigration Lawyers Association to discuss the current state of the Central American refugee crisis. Last year, he led a delegation with members of Congress to visit detention centers in Texas that were housing Central American refugees, moms and kids. He says a year later, little has been done to reduce the inflow of refugees and ensure their due process and a fair asylum procedure. Joining us now with the Chicago chapter from the American Immigration Lawyers Association is Michael Jarecki. He's also an immigration attorney in Chicago. Good morning, Michael. Welcome to the 21st.
Good morning, Nyla. Thank you for having me.
I wonder if you can explain a little to our audience that when we say that the average wait time, it's actually 1,046 days. What does that mean if you have a pending case and your average wait is almost 3 years?
Yes. The basic understanding in, that one needs to know about that is it takes 3 years for somebody to get a final hearing in front of an immigration judge in order to understand if they can stay in the United States or if the U.S. government is in fact going to execute a deportation or removal order against them. So during those 3 years, they may be in complete legal limbo and not have any understanding of what's going to happen to them when they finally get that final, what's called merits hearing.
And while they're in limbo, do they have the legal authorization to work or to go to school or even to, and I guess in Illinois, everyone can get a driver's license, but...
Correct. So some do and some don't. When we talk about asylees and asylum applicants, yes, they will be authorized to get work authorization in the United States after 150 days of their case pending. However, that's all that does is give them work authorization. They don't have much right to access many benefits that would be available to them once they get a grant or an approval of asylum. They can't access health care in public exchanges. They can't access tuition scholarships or tuition grants that normally would be available to people who are permanent residents in the United States or U.S. citizens. So in a way, yes, it gives them a small slice to work and support themselves while they're in the United States, but there's a huge cost to that three-year delay because they're never getting closer to getting the full benefits that many of these asylum seekers who get grants are going to be able to access. So but for the delays, they would be able to access all of those benefits quite quicker in a more expeditious fashion.
And apart from asylum seekers, what other kind of cases are these? Are these people who have overstayed visas? Who else is in this process, in the system?
Yeah, so anyone who is not in the United States with authorization can be put into immigration court proceedings. The types of cases that we see are asylum because if somebody has filed at the asylum office in one of the offices throughout the country, but here in the Chicago office, if their case isn't approved, it is mandatorily referred to the immigration court in Chicago. So that's the reason why we see a lot of immigration asylum court cases. Other cases include people who have been here for an extremely long time who might have family members, such as a U.S. citizen spouse or U.S. citizen children, who would suffer severely if the individual who's in immigration deportation proceedings would actually be removed from the United States. So those individuals can present a case in front of a judge and ask for the judge to cancel their removal and grant them permanent resident status in the United States.
And those cases are also seeing a wait time of about 3 years.
Absolutely.
So, what happens, Michael? Do they go to the court and then they literally the judge says, come back in 2019 or 2018?
Unfortunately, that's literally what happens. So somebody will have a hearing with a judge where a judge can have just a check-in and get an overview of the case. And at that time, there's a charging document against the individual called a notice to appear. And that's where the U.S. government says facts and allegations against an individual, such as you are a citizen from X country, you are in the United States unlawfully, and we seek to return you to this country. So there are some procedural and administrative things that happen. And then if the person is eligible to seek benefits in the United States, the judge will put them to a final hearing. And the final hearing, the judge will go through his or her calendar and find a court date. And unfortunately, the immigration court in Chicago is so slammed that many cases in my firm and others who practice in Chicago and in the region are getting a holding date for November 2019. So it's understood that though there is that date, the individual is not going to get their final hearing on that date because they're putting a lot of people on the same date, knowing that if they get more resources, if they get more judges, if they have the ability to hear this case sooner, they will put somebody into a future date. But unfortunately, the way things are looking, it may be that they will be put into a further date.
And before, I want to get into the resources question in a minute, but I want to go back to something you said about particularly clients. And I know you have a client who's currently awaiting a hearing for asylum, and he's legally married to a U.S. citizen. If you're someone who's in a situation like that, does that speed the process along?
It could, but there are many nuances and many complications to our immigration laws. So the general rule is if you are married to a U.S. citizen, you may have the opportunity to move forward and obtain a green card in the United States or permanent resident status. However, individuals who come into the United States without first obtaining a visa are punished by the U.S. government. And even if they're married to a U.S. citizen, they have to prove that their relationship is in good faith. And then if they want to obtain the permanent benefit, they still have to go home to their home country, seek the benefit at the U.S. Embassy or consulate, and then if they're approved, come back into the United States. But there's a caveat there that anyone who's lived in the United States for more than 1 year out of status will trigger a 10-year bar the moment they try to leave the United States. So before they could even go forward and get that final interview abroad, they have to seek another waiver in the United States to waive the 10-year bar so that they will not be stuck or punished for 10 years outside of the United States.
Michael, when we're thinking about why this backlog exists, you mentioned earlier, you mentioned resources, you mentioned judges. We know that there are, first of all, there's 20,000 pending deportation cases. Is it correct that that's just for Illinois right now?
That's correct.
And is this
the Chicago Immigration Court?
And the Chicago Immigration Court processes everybody throughout the state. So if you're no matter what part of the state, and you're probably going to be processed through Chicago, although I guess maybe in some cases there might be some processing in St. Louis.
Correct. But even those in Indiana process in the Chicago Immigration Court.
Mm-hmm. Is the problem worse in Illinois than in other parts of the country?
Well, there's about 485,000 cases nationally that are pending. So Chicago is one of the worst, but I believe there are others that are even more backlogged.
So you mentioned that number. Over the past decade, that number that you said, that 485,000, that's actually quadrupled the number of cases in the system. Why have the cases, why is there so much of a backlog, and why has that grown over the past 10 years?
Well, there's a combination of factors. One is staffing and the ability to retain and bring on more immigration judges. Just in Chicago, we've seen several judges retire, and they were not replaced in any fashion whatsoever. Just this past April, we received one new judge. There's an understanding that there will be further judges, possibly this year or next year, who come on. But when we talk about the structure of the immigration court, there are the number of bodies and judges who actually sit and hear cases, and then there's the allocation of which judges are going to hear which type of cases. So if people are in detention and mandatorily detained by the U.S. government, the immigration court has to prioritize those cases and has to hear those cases because those individuals are being detained by at great government expense, and the government wants to push those cases through quicker, and they're more of a priority for the government. So at times, if there's ever a retirement, which there was, where the judge was hearing a detained docket, then somebody who was hearing other cases where people were not detained, that judge's docket was completely put on hold, and then that judge would move to the detained docket. So people like my client, who is waiting for that 3-year date to come, could, if they're in the line to be seen by that particular judge, might have those cases kicked as well. Whichever prioritization happens, if that judge has to clear a schedule for 3 months, 6 months, a year, all those people who were waiting on their calendars saying, okay, great, June 2016 is going to be my date, get a letter in the mail saying you're now kicked for November 2019 and we'll contact you when you can come back in. So it's an extremely devastating thing when that happens.
Yeah. Well, what I want to ask you about these detention people who are in detention centers, as I mentioned at the beginning of this, Representative Gutierrez, he's a Democratic representative from Chicago, last year took a delegation to Texas to visit some centers. Where are these detention centers? Who's being held in them? And who would be in a detention center with a case that would be processed through a Chicago court?
Yeah, so in Chicago, many people who are in detention, who are mandatorily detained, may have serious crimes where the law requires them to be detained. That could be crimes involving firearms, drugs, things called in the immigration system crimes involving moral turpitude, which might have to do with theft or fraud, people who might have illegally reentered. So if somebody was deported previously and then came back into the United States and was found, those people would be detained and aggravated, people with aggravated felonies. Mm. Now, that's not the only people who are in detention. Also, people who could not afford a bond once a judge determines, okay, is this person a flight risk? They may not be a risk to society in the sense that they were charged with a crime or have a conviction, but other factors of whether they have family ties in the United States, how long have they been in the United States. So that all comes into play, and if a high bond is set, it may be that, yes, that person can get out if they can pay that amount of money, but they don't have the resources even to pool that amount of money to get the person out. So that person might be detained. But something else I wanted to talk about in terms of the delays, we talked about the resources and the prioritization. There was, in 2014, and there continues to be, an influx of refugees from Central America. These individuals are fleeing violence and harm in their home country, and they're coming to the southern border of the United States. And the United States is doing the best that they can to process these people, but their best is pushing them through an immigration system, executing an immediate deportation order, and trying to send them back to their home country.
Yeah, and I actually wanted to play. We have Luis Gutierrez, Representative Gutierrez, was actually just speaking about this an hour ago, and he was actually calling on Secretary of State John Kerry to take action.
On a very basic level, I'm saying that the United States should treat this refugee crisis in our own hemisphere, in the region that we are used to control 100% or better, for better or for worse, through the Monroe Doctrine, and work with our allies in the region to address the crisis as a crisis, a refugee crisis. I think this is the moment we need the Secretary of State, Kerry, to step up. I get it. Secretary Kerry is working hard on Syria and other big problems. But we have a big problem close that needs his attention too, real close.
And he's, of course, that's Representative Luis Gutierrez this morning, just a couple of minutes ago, talking about this as a Central American refugee crisis. Michael, you know, we just have about a minute left. And I think as we fold all of this in, as you're mentioning the Central American, the influx of refugees from Central America, we have so many conversations about how our immigration system is broken, and I think this conversation is an example of that. That's, you know, that statement that our immigration system is broken is something that is met with bipartisan support. As you're thinking about all of this, I guess my question to you is, do you see enough resources being devoted to trying to just even solve the backlog of the problem of immigrants who are here through the court system?
I don't think so, because if there were enough resources that were being allocated, we would see government-guaranteed lawyers for women and children coming from Central America. And that's an important point in our immigration courts and for people who are seeking asylum. The government does not guarantee anyone a representative. They have to find them at their own expense. And sometimes,
and that includes children as well?
It includes children. Children have to go to immigration court and be self-represented. They do not get a government advocate.
That's Michael Jarecki. He's an immigration attorney in Chicago. He's also with the American Immigration Lawyers Association and the Chicago chapter, joining us a little bit more on this backlog. Michael, thanks very much.
Thank you.
I'm afraid that's all the time we have for today. A note on our previous conversation earlier this hour, we've got a list of all the upcoming vigils across Illinois to honor Orlando shooting victims. It's on our website. We'll also tweet out the link. Head to 21stshow.org. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks so much for listening. I'm going to be out for the next couple days. We've got some hosts filling in, so stay tuned to the 21st tomorrow.